I've been working basically for the last 5 years or so, I guess, trying to put together a model of the evolution of human cooperation and social life, focusing on, just to sort of, you know, make the project concrete and tractable, the evolution of social learning. And what I've been trying to do over the last few months is start to think reasonably seriously about how that model might throw some light on the evolution of language. In the book that I've got coming out about the evolution of social learning, I do talk a bit about the evolution of communication generally, but I try and be as uncommittal as possible, at least as uncommittal as I could get away with in that chapter about language, so the time has come to stick my neck out a bit more about that. Okay, so in discussions of the evolution of language, often you get a whole series of sort of key questions or key issues, and four of the really standard ones that you'll come across in almost every discussion of the evolution of language are these four questions. So one question is, why did language only evolve in our lineage? You know, if language is a kind of powerful adaptive tool, why only us? So the uniqueness problem is one of them. The second, and this is often what discussions of the evolution of language focus on, is the problem of deception and the threat that deception would pose to the stable use of language. So the thought is that when communication is expensive, when signals are expensive in some way, the cost of the signals can in various ways underwrite their honesty and reliability. So the honesty problem doesn't really arise, or it's solved in systems of costly communication. But talk is cheap. Sending a linguistic signal is not a costly act. So what is it that explains the fact that linguistic communication is not honest? Of course, it's not perfectly honest. People do lie and deceive. But they don't lie and deceive so much as to destabilize the system. And that's seen in the eyes of many people as an absolutely central problem in understanding the evolution of language. A third feature, and a very critical difference between linguistic communication and the communication systems of many animals, is that language terms are stimulus independent. That's to say, most of the words that you will read or utter or hear in ordinary conversations are not uttered in the direct presence of their reference. Of course, sometimes they are. For example, when you introduce someone to someone that they haven't met. But most uses of language aren't like that. Most, you know, of the times that I say beer or wine, it's not because there's beer or wine in my immediate vicinity, it's because there's not. And that is true of most language use. So you've got to explain its stimulus independence. And also, finally, last problem I'll talk about today is the issue about syntax. Again, in the eyes of many people who think about language and the evolution of language, the core feature of language is what's sometimes called the making infinite use of finite resources. And by that, what's meant is that lexicons are finite. In contemporary languages, they're large, but they're finite. But the number of possible utterances, the number of possible atomic utterances that people can produce is open-ended. It's hyper-astronomical. How is that possible? It's possible because the rules of language, the syntactic rules of language, give us recipes for assembling words into sentences, and there's no upper bound into the on the complexity of structures which can be so assembled. So you've got to explain why language is a recipe-organized system. You've got to explain why language, you know, consists of utterances which are syntactically structured, syntactically organized in ways such that the meaning of the whole thing can be understood in terms of the meaning and arrangement of the parts. Now, I'm going to boldly claim that the story that I tell about the evolution of human communication and social learning and cooperation can tell us something about all four of those problems. It can tell us something about uniqueness, something about stimulus independence, something about honesty, and something about syntax. Now, I'm going to very briefly, because I've talked about this before on this trip, situate that, in a model of hominid evolution, which begins with the idea that the distinctive trajectory of hominid evolution begins with organisms with great ape-like social, cognitive, and ecological skills, hypothesizes a ecological and morphological trigger, and then explains the distinctive features of human social life, and there are many, many distinctive features of human social life in terms of positive feedback between different forms of cooperation. And by that, I mean informational cooperation, I mean reproductive cooperation, and I mean ecological cooperation. And the basic idea is to connect the sort of model of the evolution of the distinctive forms of human social life with the thought that language began as gesture, a thought that's becoming increasingly popular at the moment. And so the thought is that the distinctive trajectory of hominid life, amongst other things, saw an absolutely massive expansion of sort of technical motor skills. One of the things which distinguishes humans from the other great apes is our far more elaborated technical intelligence, our much richer and our much more explicitly represented behavioral programs. Now, that's one thing that's going on. I think there's good independent reasons for thinking that that's a distinctive trajectory of the hominid evolutionary trajectory for roughly the last 3.5 million years. Because I think that there's beginning to be evidence that we've been tool-using primates, using stone tools, and being increasingly dependent on technology for the last 3.5 million years. And the increasing dependence of technology and the increasing dependence on complex technology, is what's fueling, the evolution of these elaborated and expanded motor technical skills. Put that together with the idea that language originated as an expansion of gestural communication, and so the thought then is to think of language as just a special case of the expansion of these techno-motor skills. And if you think of language as a special case of the expansion of these techno-motor skills, then many of the distinctive features of language start to make more sense. You start to be able to give a non-miraculous explanation of their emergence. To steal a line from Russell. Okay. As I say, I'm not going to, talk about the sort of basic model of the evolution of human sort of sociality, much, because a lot of people here have already heard that on this trip. But the basic idea is that there was an ecological triggering condition. And that's the increased seasonality of early hominid environments and the shift from forest to woodland and grassland life. Accompanying that shift in habitat and in environmental exposure is a shift to becoming fully bipedal. And that had certain consequences. It had the consequences of expanding range size and increasing selection for capacities to track and navigate. It freed hands for all sorts of things. One of those is gesture, another is for the specialisation of motor control in these techno-motor skills. And later, regular tool use, maybe from perhaps between 3.5 and 2.5 million years ago, became an important anchor in this whole process, both enhancing and stabilising selection for these techno-motor skills as tool use moved from being an occasional and supplementary feature of human lifeways to a situation in which the adept construction and use of tools became an essential and anchoring feature of hominin lifeways. As a result of that, human diets improved and that released energetic constraints on brains and guts. Mixed up with all of this in very complex ways are co-evolutionary interactions which lead to an expansion of cooperation and social learning. As I say, that was very brief, but lots of people have heard that before. Okay, so given the trigger, you know, given that these changes in environment and lifeways, the sort of the distinctive trajectory from roughly 2.5 million years ago to the establishment of behaviourally modern humans about 50,000 years ago was driven, you know, by this co-evolutionary interaction between ecological cooperation, humans evolved as social foragers, reproductive cooperation, and information pooling and cultural learning. Okay, so that's the background picture of what was happening in hominid evolution in the last 2.5 to 3 million years. I disagree with an enormous amount of Derek Bickerton's new book on language evolution, Adam Spoke, but one thing I don't disagree with him about is that theories of the evolution of language have to be kind of anchored and contextualised within an overall picture of how and why humans evolved into the very distinctive and different kinds of primates that we are. So I begin with the first of the questions, why only us? Why did language appear only in our lineage? Terry Deacon gives a very vivid, you know, sort of view of that question and its power at the beginning of his very interesting, though not wholly convincing book, The Symbolic Species. And he sort of poses that question at the beginning, why does no other animal use a language, even a simple language? As Deacon says, perhaps the complexity of human language is understandable given the complexity of human minds and the complexity of human social environments, but why couldn't, you know, other languages, chimps or whatever, just speak a simple and cut down but still recognisable version of a human language? Now, I think I was very struck when I read Deacon's book by that question and by the vividness with which he posed it. But I actually think that question is often put in slightly the wrong way. It's often put as the question, what was it about hominids or about hominid environments that explain why we and only we evolved language? Now, you might think that's the very same question as the question about why language is unique to us, but it's actually not. Ask instead, I say, why did only hominins evolve as cooperative foragers? Why are we the only hominin species that evolved that way, specialising in high value and heavily defended resources, and hence a life way which depended on both ecological cooperation and the rich assembly of informational resources about the environment and the technical equipment needed to exploit that environment? And I say, once you answer that question, you get an answer to the language question for free. So this particular life way, the hominid, social foraging life way, selects strongly for coordinated cooperation and expertise. Our ancestors of 400,000 to 500,000 years ago were, for example, successfully hunting large dangerous game with relatively simple technology. The only way they could do that successfully and at reasonably low risk was by cooperating and by knowing themselves and knowing their environment. Coordinated cooperation, natural history expertise, and an adept use of their simple technology was critical. And hence you get selection for that. And as part of selection for that, you get selection for social learning and for adult-to-adult signalling in planning and cooperation, both in advance and on the fly. You need, if you're hunting Cape buffalo, and 400,000 years ago in Africa, people were hunting animals as large and dangerous as that. You don't turn up as an unruly mob armed with a couple of sharp sticks and try and poke them in the head with them. That will not lead to a happy outcome, at least not for you. Okay, right. So, on this view, the evolution of language is preceded by a general expansion of social and communicative skills. You need a general expansion of social and communicative skills, both to engage in planned behaviour, both individual planned behaviour, but more to the point in this context, collective planned behaviour. You need it for the various forms of social learning that gradually became important in our lineage, imitation learning, learning from gesture, mime, and demonstration, and you need theory of mind skills. So preceding what you might think of as the evolution of true language, or even the evolution of rich forms of proto-language, you have a general expansion of social learning, of cooperation capacities, of communicative capacities, and social learning. Seen that way, the evolution of language isn't a sort of atom. It is not something, it's not a feature whose evolution is to be explained independently of other features of the human cooperation, cognition suite. Rather, it's part of the evolution of that suite, and I suspect it wasn't a kind of distinctive and identifiable feature. It wasn't an identifiable subsystem until reasonably late, maybe something like halfway through the transition from roughly great ape social lives to the social lives of behaviourally modern humans 50,000 years ago or so. And so there's a genuine uniqueness problem lurking around, all right. But the uniqueness problem is that of explaining why we, or rather, why our ancestors were the only great apes to go down the social foraging road. Once you've explained that, once you've explained, why hominins and only hominins evolved as cooperative, expert, technologically assisted foragers, there's no extra problem in explaining why we were the only lineage to in which you saw the evolution of language, because that evolutionary transition was the sort of essential evolutionary platform from which the even more distinctive features of language emerged. Okay, how am I going for time? Not too bad. As I mentioned in the sort of preliminary sparring, a lot of people take the honesty problem to be the absolutely critical problem in explaining the evolution of language, because they think, if a communication communication systems amongst individuals who don't have identical interests will destabilize unless there's something keeping them honest, because there'll be temptations to deceive and individual agents will be under selection to succumb to those temptations to deceive. And as the ratio of deceptive communication to honest communication increases, the system will destabilize and collapse. People will stop speaking, people will stop listening, or somehow the system has to transition to some system where the communicative utterances are kept honest by their cost. So either the whole communication system falls over, or it becomes another form of expensive communication. And hence, as I say, a lot of people who worry about the evolution of language worry about the evolution of language precisely centered around the problem of honesty. Now, I think the problem of honesty is oversold. I don't think it is not a problem at all, but I think the problem of honesty is not nearly as pervasive as these theorists suppose. And I have in other talks about honesty, I have a couple of standard examples which I use to sort of illustrate the fact that yes, deception can be a threat, but no, it's not always a threat. One of the examples is an old board game, which is now morphed, I gather, onto an online game called Diplomacy. Now, the basic structure of Diplomacy, the game, is that everyone in the game basically takes the role of one of the European great powers of about the beginning of the 20th century, counting the Turkish Empire as a great power, and the object of the game is to come to dominate the world. And the only way you can do this, the only successful strategy in the game is by forming and breaking alliances. No one's powerful enough just to squash everyone. The game wouldn't be any fun if that was true. So you've got to form alliances, so some of you gang up on someone else and squash them and divide the spoils between them. But at some stage, if you're going to win, you've got to betray your partner. And everyone knows this. So diplomacy illustrates the honesty problem that people obsess about. Because diplomacy is a situation in which you're required to talk and listen. There's no way of winning the game as a silent mute. You can't opt out of communication and hope to succeed. But in your own conversation, you'll often be tempted, to deceive, but you can't always deceive, because then you won't even be trusted, provisionally. And you must trust others provisionally, but you trust others provisionally knowing that at some stage someone is bound to be trying to deceive you. And so you've got this very difficult, problem of understanding how communication, cheap communication, can be possible in the diplomacy game. The other example is a famous example from Monty Python, the Hungarian phase book. For those of you who've not seen this, the basic idea of the sketch, is a sort of a poor Hungarian, adrift in England with a Hungarian or an English phrase book, trying to get help, in an English shop with his phrase book, but it's a malicious and deceptive phrase book. So when he, is trying to ask the way to the railway station, what he actually says is, "May I fondle your buttocks," and so on. So needless to say, unbearable social catastrophe befalls him. It's incredibly funny, but one of the things that makes it funny is that the sort of setup scenario is so bizarre. There are many dangers in social life, and there are many dangers in travelling in foreign countries, but buying a deceptive phrase book is not one of them. And as we go on, I hope to give you a kind of systematic account of why that's true, why despite the fact that that's a cheap talk conversation, there's actually no threat of deception in cases like that. So basic point is, yes, deception is a threat, but it's a variable threat. It doesn't arise all the time. It doesn't pervade every linguistic and communicative situation. And because it's a variable threat, you can give an account of the evolution of communicative capacities, which begin with relatively safe channels. And as the evolutionary transition of increasing communication goes through, there's selection for the evolution of cognitive mechanisms, including cognitive mechanisms which help guard you from the threat of deception. Dan Sperber recently, for example, has been arguing, I think very plausibly, that our meta-representational capacities, amongst other things, evolved to help guard us from the threat of deception. But those, you can't posit, you know, capacities of that kind at the beginning of these transitions from relatively sparse communication to very rich communication. Rather, you've got to give an account of how evolution can be, you know, there can be the evolution of quite rich communication, and because we're communicating a lot, then there is then selection for the evolution of sort of anti-deception cognitive technologies. So yes, honesty is an issue, but it's not the all-pervading monster that it's been portrayed as. Okay, now, so how did it all get going? This feeds back to the original model of the evolution of distinctive sociality that I talked about, namely the role of, you know, skill acquisition. The point of skill acquisition is that it can begin as a very low-risk form of communication. Indeed, it begins without real communication at all. Skill acquisition can begin, you know, simply social learning by kids that's facilitated as a pure byproduct of adult activity. But as it proceeds, you know, as there's selection for learning and teaching, there's communication, all right, but it's communication that's anchored in the material substrate and the trial and error activities of the kid, you know, learning the capacity. Because they're getting communications about what to do and how to do it in contexts where it can be immediately tested against the material substrate, and because much of this is proceeding in public in many, many communicative channels rather than one-one communicative channels, there's very little opportunity or risk of deception. So you can get cooperation and communication going in these contexts of socially mediated and enhanced trial and error learning, where the veracity of the communication is immediately tested against the material substrate. And for that reason, you can get, you know, that offers a plausible picture of how communication can grow in its importance in the hominid lineage, at least in the early phases, without serious threat of deception, but it will nonetheless select for the capacities that aid in the deception management later on, because one of the things that it will be selecting for is enhanced theory of mind skills in both teaching and learning from others. It's advantageous to have some theory of mind skills. For example, in teaching, it's advantageous to understand what the other agent knows and does not know. In learning, it's very important to understand what someone is doing when they're trying, for example, to demonstrate a skill, because demonstrations are often systematically different from skills performed for real, you know, in their standard ecological context. So selection for skill transmission leaves the lineage posed for the evolution of more complex, more abstract, more language-like communication. And that's not all that's going on. One of the crucial differences between diplomacy and the Hungarian phrasebook is the difference between private talk and public talk. Diplomacy is private talk. It's one-on-one negotiation. And that's much riskier than public talk. In many, many networks, a signal can't, calculate, or you can't usually calculate the effects of a deceptive signal because you don't know what else the other person is getting as you speak. Receivers can compare messages from different sources, and that will also expose deceptive attempts. And moreover, many, many networks can exploit the reliability, of signalling through, various Condorcet-like effects. So in general, public talk is much less risky than private talk. It's more reliable, because it buffers you against not just deception, but ordinary error and signal degradation, but it also makes, attempts to deceive much less likely because they're more likely to be exposed, they're less likely to be successful, and their upshot is less predictable because in the public context, you don't know who is going to respond, if anyone, to your deceptive signal. Now, that's not always going to be true, of course. There'll be special circumstances. But in general, the threat of deception is much, much higher in private talk than public talk. The domains about which you talk make a difference too, even in environments with where interests aren't in common. So in contexts of bargaining, in exchanging social information and third-party gossip, you do have this difficult balance between others being potentially important sources of information, but others also having the temptation to deceive you. So, if you're listening to someone, especially in private talk, telling you scandalous stories about the next door neighbour, you want to listen in case the stories are true. You want to listen anyway, even if they're not true. But you want to know whether they're true or not. And, people do maliciously gossip for various Machiavellian ends of their own. Contrast that, say, with information about customs. Now, it's not hard to tell, somewhat contrived, even occasionally true stories, about people being deceived at All Souls, about the incredibly complex seating rules. You turn up, you realise that the person who's a visitor is your rival for the next job, so you set out to sabotage them, by telling them that it's the custom not to wear your trousers to dinner. They blindly go ahead and do it. It's no more unusual than the other rituals, after all. And so they're sunk. So it's possible to tell stories of that kind, but almost all information about customs and norms we don't acquire like that. Partly because when you do tell someone, about the customs and norms, that information isn't tied to specific courses of action. So again, you don't know the consequences of deception. People get lots of information of this kind, not just through communication, but through leakage. You see how other people are behaving. You notice that you're the only person not wearing your trousers, and so on. And a lot of this information is, acquired through many, many networks. So even though lots of information about customs and norms you get through language, through cheap signals, it's a low risk form of communication. There's very little deception. There's obviously some, but there's very little deception in communication about that particular content domain. So the bottom line is that while diplomacy cases are important, and I don't think they're just an artifact of contemporary life, they're not the standard example of human communication. They're not even the standard example of human communication using cheap signals. They're the extreme end of a spectrum because they maximise both temptation and risk. They're not a paradigm case of information sharing in human life, and certainly they're not early paradigm cases. So yes, language does expose you in certain rather special contexts to serious risks of deception, risks that you can't completely avoid, risks that you can only manage through late evolving cognitive capacities like fancy meta-representational capacities and the kind of folk logic, the logic of plausibility and evidence that Dan Sperber thinks we evolved to be able to use in these communicative situations. But this all arrives late on the back of rich evolutionary transitions of using language and other communicative capacities, because many human communication systems, even those using cheap signals, don't pose this kind of risk. Okay, about 10 minutes to go. Okay, stimulus independence. I'll have to speed up a little. So, Merlin Donnell argues, I think, with great plausibility, that rich communication in our lineage began with things like mimes or charades. Basic thought is, you know, that mimes and charades are iconic rather than arbitrary. And because they're iconic rather than arbitrary, people, you know, our ancestors had a decent chance of understanding them, especially given, you know, the sort of rich background information each would have about the other and the circumstances. And I think that's, you know, as far as that goes, I think that's right and important. But it actually presupposes rather than explains stimulus independence, because Donald is supposing that we have the capacity both to produce and understand mime and charade-like performances, you know, in the absence of what they would be about. You know, the whole point of producing a mime, say, of an injured animal at a waterhole is to recruit people to go to the waterhole and finish the animal off. So he presupposes, you know, that we have this capacity to produce stimulus-independent signals and the capacity, at least fallibly, to decode those symbols, thinking that all of this is empowered by the iconicity of the performance. I agree, iconicity matters, but by itself, it doesn't explain stimulus independence. Now, how did we acquire the capacity to produce these sorts of mimes or demonstrations or gestures in a context-independent way? Okay, so here's how the idea is going to go. I'm going to sort of suggest, you know, that as we were selected for increasingly complex motor skills, we were selected for the capacity to represent those motor skills, to be able to use them, you know, take those motor skills offline, to demonstrate aspects of them, to practice them. You know, I'm an unbelievably bad cricketer, but even I have practiced my cricket shots, you know, in front of a mirror, checking my footwork and whether the bat is going through straight. I've often done it even without a bat, just doing this. You know, lots of humans, you know, sort of have the capacity, we all have the capacity to take elements of these motor skills offline for practice, for demonstration, and to correct ourselves and others. You've got to be able to think about your capacity when it's going wrong in order to help diagnose what's going wrong. Now, that capacity, you know, just is, you know, the capacity to perform skills, you know, not cued by the immediate physical environment, but cued by some kind of internal representation of the skill. So that's what you need. You know, the selection for the top-down representation of the behavioural program, and to use elements of that program, not in face-to-face activity with its usual substrate, is precisely the capacity that you need in order to do things offline. Okay, I have to hurry. Okay, so gestural origins, great apes, already do gestures. They use gesture as social tool under top-down control. They don't do that for vocalization. And speech, is complex and difficult. So one reason why I think that language begins as gesture is that communication already has to be important in our lineage before you can have selection for the costly and complex neural adaptations you need for speech. So gesture and mime come first. Once they become absolutely central in our life, then for various reasons not well understood, the communicative mode gets switched from hand to mouth. I've just said this, but very briefly, the thought is that when physical skills are relatively simple, they can be implicit and automatic, in confrontation with the physical substrate. I think Alderman technology was simple. That was that simple. I don't think you needed inner templates or top-down representations of napping skills to perform Alderman technology. But by 800,000 years ago, with a later Schulian, the technology was becoming increasingly complex, increasingly needing, demonstration, auto-cued practice and so on to acquire these skills, and hence increasingly under the control of inner templates. That becomes especially important by, say, 300,000 years ago, when people are starting to use transformative technologies. So here's the central argument up here. Complex structured motor skills require meta-representation of the skill to enable demonstration and self-correction. That just is decoupling the execution of the skill from the stimulus. The skill routine is now, at least in part, under top-down control rather than stimulus-grounded. It allows shadow performance of the skill, not now just in demonstration, but in mime and in gesture. So, for example, a demonstration of breaking open bones without wasting the marrow can be, can become recruited as a mime, increasing the presence of such a resource because you now have the capacity to execute skills shadow. They're no longer, anchored to the material substrate. They're now anchored instead or as well to templates in the mind. Okay, let me very briefly finish with some speculations on syntax. And the basic idea is that syntax begins as something like basket weaving. There's a very entertaining beginning of Margaret Bowden's book, Computer Models of the Mind, when she uses knitting as an example of what a structured algorithm is. A knitting pattern, has this recursive structure. You repeatedly do, a particular procedure until you reach threshold, and then the whole, sequence moves on to the next element of the pattern, and something similar goes again. So syntax is accepted from this capacity to represent technomotor skills as a behavioural program, as a hierarchically organised sort of representation of a sequence of motor patterns, with each element represented as a structure. Once it's represented as a structure, that particular structure, then can be elaborated in various ways, while the rest of the representation is left intact, and so on. So why I think, this was important in our lineage, two different, routes into this idea. One from Robert Byrne and Dietrich Stout via the idea of a behavioural program as extracting foraging became increasingly important. Byrne argued that apes developed behavioural programs. Maybe so, but if they did, they seemed to be, you know, more or less implicit behavioural programs, as though the technical skills became increasingly complex, increasingly dependent on social learning and teaching. The behavioural program becomes much more richly represented. It's structured in various ways. And so if that's what a behavioural program is, and if language began as gesture and elaborated as gesture, then complex gestures just come out as a special case of a behavioural program. If behavioural programs are in general represented by agents as structured and organised, then gestural sequences will be represented as structured and organised, and that's either syntax or at least the beginnings of syntax. One more slide and I'll stop. Give you the second idea, which derives from Mike Tomasello, who got a Guernsey yesterday. You'll get another tick today. So Tomasello points out that humans are way better at cooperating with one another in situations which require individuals to do different things. And Tomasello suggests that in part that's because agents represent complex activities with what he calls bird's eye representations. Bird's eye representations are representations of complex activities where the roles are specified, but the particular agents in the roles are not specified. So I represent a joint activity, you know, say with Celia, in which someone has to do X and someone else has to do Y, but I don't represent it as me having to do X and Celia having to do Y. If I've got a representation of a collective activity like that, it makes it easy to understand how Celia and I can switch roles, you know, in performing it. Say, you know, carrying some light but awkward object, you know, upstairs. We can do that. Apes can't. They're pretty hopeless at it. Why is that? A long history of cooperative foragers explain why. We have long been under selection, not just for cooperative activities, not just for coordinated activities, but for cooperative and coordinated activities in which different agents had to take different roles at different times. And that requires us to make a crucial distinction. The crucial distinction between role and occupant. When I represent a joint activity with Celia, while representing roles but not occupants, that's a crucial cognitive breakthrough in the representation of a structured activity that you need for syntax. The whole, you know, not the whole point of syntax, but one absolutely critical feature of syntax is that the syntactic concepts are role concepts, not occupant concepts. Once you have the role-occupant distinction, you can represent, you know, a complex behavioural sequence and ultimately a sentence, you know, in ways which don't specify which term or which elementary gesture goes into the subject position or the object position or the action position. Okay. Sorry, I've run over time a bit. So the basic idea has been to take an idea that's around, that language is a kind of cognitive, you know, technology, and take that idea literally and see what I can do with it in thinking about the evolution of cognition. I've said lots of stuff that might well be wrong, but I do think that that taking the gestural origin of language seriously in conjunction with the expansion of human technomotor skills does give us real leverage on many of these issues. And with that, I'll stop.